3, 2, 1.
We may be told isolated things about certain events that take place, but what's the overall framework that this is occurring in? And that's essential. If we don't know that Palestinians are stateless, and the only reason they're stateless is because the country which was established on their land, Israel, expressly excludes them from the benefits of nationality, well, that's a huge problem.
Welcome back to Podcast Noor. I am your guide, Noor, and today's storyteller is Lara E., also known as Ghazan Girl. I'm incredibly honored to be having Lara on today's episode. She is a resource that I use when learning and educating myself on the Palestinian struggle. She is a Palestinian-American international lawyer and activist and is currently based in Paris. Her family is originally from Gaza and Yaffa, and she acts as counsel in international disputes and dedicates a large part of her legal practice to human rights work, including accompanying asylum seekers and asylum proceedings before French jurisdictions. She also has a weekly podcast called The Palestine Pod that she co-hosts with a Jewish American comedian. They talk all things Palestine. And of course, in today's conversation, we will also be talking all things Palestine. We go into a media analysis of the media's representation of the Palestinian struggle. We go into her personal story, her family story, intergenerational trauma, and we get into detailed descriptions of her favorite Palestinian dish, which is also one of my favorite Palestinian dishes. All this and more on today's storytelling session. Grab a cup of tea or whatever it is that you prefer to drink in these fall months. And I hope you keep an open heart and mind, as this is one of the most important conversations I think we should be having these days. So, welcome to Podcast Noor. And here is our episode with Ghazan Girl. Let's go! Adam is pumping his fist into the air to cheer us on, and we have officially started the podcast. So today I'm on with another fellow podcaster, Lara E., also known as Ghazan Girl of the Palestine Pod. You have some really cool cover art. Like, I really enjoy thoughtful cover art, and you guys have like one of my favorites.
Thank you. That was a process. We worked with a graffiti artist based out of Paris to get the actual Palestine Pod part. And then I worked with a friend who's a graphic designer out of Kuwait, who actually did put it all together and did the Kifia inspiration with the graffiti.
That's amazing. That's incredible. So we always kick off our storytelling sessions by doing a heart check-in. I know we both had an interesting morning right before we got onto this pod. Well, you are in a different time zone, but I had an interesting morning. You've had an interesting day, and I would love to know how your heart is doing.
You know, my heart is good. It's somewhere between hoping my dog doesn't make too much noise because he's sitting right behind me, and
the snoring dog.
Yeah, French bulldogs. That's kind of their thing. So it's somewhere between that and just reflecting on what it is that I really want to share with you today. There's so much that can be said, and so there's a lot of things brewing in my brain right now.
I'm so excited to hear, and I'm so honored that we're going to have this storytelling session with you. Well, let's start with how you think most of the world approaches consuming stories around Palestine. Like, just generally, what is the typical relationship with the stories around Palestine?
I think it really depends on the angle that you're looking at it from. So oftentimes when we consider support for the Palestinian struggle, It's actually very popular worldwide. The majority of the world agrees that Palestinians are engaged in anti-colonial, anti-racist struggle for freedom, for liberty, for equal rights on their land, that they're resisting a foreign settler colonial force that is taking their land and that it is expelling them from it. The majority of the world is on board and gets that. And oftentimes we see that reflected in the votes in the UN General Assembly, for example, when we see basically almost the entire world vote one way to condemn Israel for its violations of international law. And then we see the lone, you know, handful, the US, Israel, and perhaps a few isolated island countries, you know, somewhere off of Asia Pacific, vote in another way. Or alternatively, if we're considering the UN Security Council when it votes, oftentimes it is the U.S. that casts the lone veto that actually acts to shield Israel from any sort of accountability for its human rights violations. So when we talk about the world's perception of Palestine, and this, I think, has been consistent over the decades, especially as other peoples were fighting anti-colonial struggles, they very much saw Palestinians as brothers and sisters in those struggles, that sort of third world struggle for freedom against the former colonial powers. When we talk, though, about those who are the loudest, those with the power, those that dominate the narrative, I think there's a little bit of a different outcome, a different story that's being told. So when we're talking, for example, about the mainstream media representation of the Palestinian struggle and the way that the story of Palestine gets told in the mainstream media, and certainly when I'm speaking about mainstream media, I'm talking about the major Western outlets, with few exceptions. Oftentimes what we see is that the story of Palestine lacks context. The simple context of one people being under occupation and the other side being an occupier. So while we might get certain facts about the fact that, for example, the Sheikh Jarrah families are resisting what the New York Times would say eviction from their homes, we're not actually told in the same article that Israel is an occupying power. Israel has been occupying the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, for decades now, that Israel has unilaterally annexed Jerusalem, and that this is in violation of international law. We're not given that context. We're not told, for example, that on one side you have a stateless people. On the other side, you have people who are offering the benefits of statehood, sovereignty, nationality to anybody from all anywhere, you know, in the world who can prove that they are Jewish. They can come and move to Israel and gain the benefits of Israeli citizenship. While the people who have been there, who have been on that land for generations and generations, going back thousands of years, cannot benefit from the same protections because the state that was created on their land expressly excludes them from it. So we're not given that sort of context in the reporting on Palestine. We may be told isolated things about certain events that take place, but what's the overall framework that this is occurring in? And that's essential. If we don't know that Palestinians are stateless, and the only reason they're stateless is because the country which was established on their land, Israel, expressly excludes them from the benefits of nationality, well, that's a huge problem. If we don't know that Palestinians don't have an army, if we don't know that Palestinians are refugees and are being prevented from returning to their land by Israel in violation of international law, in violation of their internationally recognized right of return, well, that's a problem as well. A lot of the times we are not given the context to understand what Palestinians are so upset about. Why are they resisting, right? What are their grievances about? And are they legitimate? And, you know, are they, for example, the type of grievances that you yourself would have if you were in a similar situation? And I think, unfortunately, the reason for that is because if these questions were asked and if this context were provided, well, then it would be very easy for Americans who, you know, are the first to hold things like property rights sacred and civil liberties sacred and certain constitutional protections sacred, they would be the first to identify with Palestinians and say, wait a minute, that's not right. This is an injustice here. And so that's something that unfortunately we continue to see in the mainstream media, you know, with few exception. I mean, there are some outlets that are trying to do better. The Nation, for example, recently hired Mohammed Al-Kurd as its Palestine correspondent, which was really an amazing development and hopefully will allow readers to see what the Palestinian perspective is. And not that it's a monolithic perspective either, but at least what is the perspective of this one Palestinian who lives on the ground and what are his daily experiences like?
Thank you so much for sharing all of that. It's so, like, specifically the Palestinian struggle is so interesting because so many Palestinian people who were not born in Palestine because their families had to flee, they identify as if, like, that is their homeland and that is where they are from. And I think about it in context of, like, if you're first gen, like, I'm first generation Libyan American, or my parents were born in Libya and then they came here, but they had the choice to come here. And so I didn't identify as much. The bicultural identity thing was something I always, like, I still am on the journey of, because I knew that my parents had made this choice for themselves. But it's different when you are born in a land that is not your family, like where your family is from, because you were expelled from it. And all of the Palestinians that I've known and loved have always carried this, like, the most pride of their heritage and their culture of anyone I've known. And this idea of, like, living outside of the land and sometimes not even ever having the chance to go back plays a really big role in that. How did your identity, especially, like, even your internet name, Ghazan Girl, is something that you carry with such pride, and that came from an aspect of this story of, like, part your family being scattered around the globe?
Yeah, this is something that I think about a lot. And you can't not think about it a lot if you are a refugee and if you grew up in a place that was not the place that you were from, but that you didn't do so because, you know, you chose to leave. You could have stayed, but you chose to leave. But in our case, we are being every single day actively prevented from going back to Palestine. If I wanted to move there today and exercise my right to return to my land, even though my family is from Gaza and Gaza supposedly, right, the Zionists say that they have withdrawn from Gaza and that Gaza is no longer under occupation. That, of course, is simply not true. It is very much under occupation and continues to be under siege now for, I think, going on 15 some years. But I'm not able to go back. And there is something that is really, I don't know, traumatic or very twisted about growing up, speaking a language, speaking a dialect. You know, I grew up speaking Palestinian Arabic at home. I grew up eating Palestinian food. I grew up, you know, wearing Palestinian dress. I grew up doing all these Palestinian things, but then also having this awareness that I am being actively prevented from going back to Palestine, and that the entire outcome of my life was shaped by circumstances that were the result of brutal, brutal violence carried out by a colonizer, right? Someone who certainly does not have your best interests at heart and who, you know, on the contrary, has engaged in a now over 7 decades long campaign to ethnically cleanse your land, your country from you. And so where does that leave you? That leaves you in a very precarious position, right? Because now I've grown up in the West. Now I've grown up, you know, between the US and now I live in France. But everything about the outcome of my life was fundamentally altered by this geopolitical situation, right? I don't speak my language as good as I would have. I always think about what my life would have been like, you know, if in 1948 Palestine was granted independence, like all of the former mandate countries like Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, etc., and it became a country, right? It became a state. It was accepted into the United Nations, and that we were there. And we were never expelled, and we continued to be allowed to develop as a nation, as a civilization. You know, we already had the airports and the railroads and the universities and the libraries and this is, you know, this very, very developed civilization and society. But what would have happened had we been allowed to continue on that path instead of what did happen, which was the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, the Nakba. In 1948, when Zionist militias destroyed over 500 Palestinian cities and villages and expelled their inhabitants, making them refugees in neighboring Arab countries and creating what is one of the world's largest refugee problems, and then preventing all those refugees from going back. And then once Israel became a state, seizing all their land and passing actual legislation that formalized the theft of Palestinian land by essentially saying that, oh, all this land that is vacant, is called absentee property, all this land that is vacant and which is owned by absentees is going to be transferred to the state of Israel. Well, it's that very same state that at the same time is depriving those Palestinians from their right to return to their land. So a very sort of dark and cynical process of erasing an entire people, erasing an entire civilization. And for the most part, those Palestinians continue to remain in limbo. We're still largely stateless. I mean, my grandfather will be turning 88 years old in December of this year. God bless him and give him health. He's older than the state of Israel. He was born in a place called Palestine. And yet at 88, he has no papers, no passport, no identity. And
does he talk about that?
Yeah, but it's actually funny that you ask that, because one of the projects that I wanted to do before I started my podcast, The Palestine Pod, was I developed this sort of obsession with basically memorializing and maintaining all of the memories that my grandparents had of Gaza, because it was the last generation to sort of live in Gaza with memories, right? And my idea was to record all these phone conversations with my grandfather and basically ask him every absolute, you know, thing about his life, from the very serious to the very mundane. You know, where did he go for groceries? Who were his neighbors? How many kids did they have? What were their names? You know, he used to be a math teacher, so I wanted to ask him about his students. I know that he also taught math in the refugee camps after the Nakba, from when basically the Palestinians that were expelled from what became Israel were... many of them were expelled into Gaza. Gaza today is actually 80% refugee population. My family is from there originally. And so at that time, my grandfather would go teach math in the refugee camps to those newly arrived refugees from the Nakba. And so I wanted to ask him all these stories. And my conversations were so not satisfying. He didn't remember very much. He had like few word answers. And for me, it was like this frustration of like, Sido, I need this information. Like, this is what is going to connect me to the land. I'm not there. And the only way that I can maintain my Palestinianness is through this information. And so it was a very difficult, very emotional process of just like me badgering him almost. And then I had to sort of
But what does that tell you? Like, what does that tell you about his relationship to the experience? Because even hearing you say that, all I think about is survival. Like, that's also a survival tactic. It's 100%. Something that, you know, how many different variations of that trauma has he gone through that the only way to really survive and even maybe thrive is if you're like, if you just like close doors on certain chapters that are hurting you so deeply, you know?
Yes, definitely. And I mean, we cannot underplay the, you know, the extent to which we really are living in this framework of intergenerational trauma. Totally. My grandparents were the first generation that had to find a different place to live. And for them, they ended up in Kuwait, where they were able to have residency, but never citizenship. There was a lot of racism that they suffered in Kuwait as well. And many difficulties, I mean, in terms of finding employment and being able to have fair wages. And, you know, the struggles of Palestinian communities in the Gulf have been well documented. It's neither here nor there. But the point is they were the first ones to go through this. Okay, how are we going to rebuild our lives elsewhere?
Yeah.
And then in my parents' generation, it was this trauma of, well, we don't fit in here. We're not from here. And our parents just went through something really traumatic. And so for my parents, interestingly, neither of them are activists, but they held on to education because for them, education was going to be the only way out.
That's the right? key. Yeah. That was always the key to them.
Right. So they studied and both ended up becoming physicians. And that was for them the way to sort of survive in this world. Eventually we became
and then
refugees
you
again. Yeah. Oh, eventually we wait, became sorry. Refugees again.
Yeah.
Because in the early 90s, during the Iraq invasion of Kuwait and the Gulf War, many Palestinians were fleeing Kuwait due to threats against their lives. And we ended up seeking political asylum in the U.S. with my parents and my sister. And then you have my generation that now grows up in the U.S., attains a certain level of privilege after, you know, in the initial years, which were certainly filled with struggle. But then I start to think about what's happened in the last three generations. And I can't not be an activist, right?
Well, that is one of the things I wanted to ask you is, well, there's so much stuff I want to ask you, but I will pace myself.
I got all night.
There's a lot. The work that you do as a lawyer, as an activist, as a storyteller and podcaster, and I know that journey of storytelling and resistance and speaking up is something that you started at a very young age. You started doing that from when you were a kid. Is that something that you felt was expected of you? Or was that something that you felt like was that fire something that you felt like you were born with? Or what was the realization around that and that you hypothesize is the same understanding that so many other Palestinians around the world have? And I ask this because there's always like this notion that the people who are going through the struggle itself have to also be their own activists because they're the only ones who will know like truly and understand deeply what's going on. But also like as humanity, we should not be putting that entire burden onto the people who are already dealing with the trauma. So how do you reconcile all of this?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. For me, it was something I was definitely born with. I tell this story often, but I think it serves as an example. When I was something like 5, 6 years old, we had to do like a Thanksgiving sort of reenactment. I'm sure you did this too.
Yeah.
Where you were, you know, one half of the class is
one person
pilgrims.
Is a native. Yeah. Yep.
And half of the class is Native Americans. I mean, it's all propaganda, right? Now that we have relearned history.
Also and super problematic, but okay. Like
super problematic.
We learned cultural appropriation in school.
Yeah. And, you know, in a celebratory way, right?
Yeah.
And I remember being assigned to be a settler, and I just broke down in tears because I knew what they had done was wrong. And this is a bit dark, but, you know, I had already known by six, you know, by that age.
How that was, it refugee. Because your parents told you that?
Because I had the memory. I had the memory of being, my earliest memory is me being 3.5 years old at the airport in Kuwait, wearing pajamas, hugging my grandfather goodbye, and asking my parents when I was going to see him again. And of course, the answer is like when you're 17 and you become a U.S. citizen and then you can finally travel again. You know,
that was what they told you?
No, but that's what happened, right? and you know, like memories are weird because I don't know if it's something that I remember because it is my first form memory at 3.5, or because that story was told to me and then, you know, it imprinted the memory and it reinforced it. I don't know.
It still creates the impact.
But that's my first memory. And so, and I have an uncle in Kuwait too, who is a scholar of Native American studies and a scholar of history. And he writes a lot about Palestinian history and also indigenous history in the U.S. And it was really through conversations with him and knowing who he was. I mean, the first gift he got me as like a very young kid was a Native American doll. That was my first doll. And so I knew that there was something about this community, about these people that was like us and that we were like them.
Wow.
And so I couldn't fathom at 6 years old or at seven, whenever this happened, being a settler in that moment because I knew it was fundamentally unjust.
Do you remember your teacher's reaction?
Yeah, it was like, you can't change. You are a settler. And I know that this happened because there's a photo of me from that day where I came home, and you can see that I had been crying all day. My mom took a picture of me with my Native American doll. And that photo exists, and I've posted it on Instagram. And, you know, I think you're exactly right. There are some people that can't do this work. There are some people that are not meant to be activists, that don't want to be activists. There are some people for whom it is too traumatizing. There are some people who are still living in the trauma on a day-to-day basis who don't have the luxury to also be out there educating people. And I use that word very intentionally because in some ways it is a luxury. You have to have a certain level of tolerance for a lot of vitriol, attacks. I mean, you know this, you're in the public space and you get those messages too. And that's okay. But for me, it was something that I didn't choose. You know, it's almost like cliche and really ridiculous to say. It's like, I didn't choose it. It just chose me because I'm so fundamentally disturbed by injustice that like I have this energy and then I have to put it somewhere.
Yeah, right. I mean, it feels like the fire is still here and you've actually been able to not only study and understand. I mean, you understand more about where you and your family's story than most people do. And unfortunately, obviously, it's come from a place of not really having another choice and having to understand it because your culture and your heritage is so politicized, and also somehow a blessing because the culture and heritage is so rich and the stories are so important and the people in it are so important. And that's why this, I don't want to say the concept of, but just the entity of ethnic cleansing that is involved in this is so heavy. Because one, ethnic cleansing, when referring to the Palestinian struggle, is such a like contested word among people. People get, it's like when you're talking about the Palestinian struggle and then that phrase specifically comes up, the conversation is, it's very hard to take it into different directions if people are resistant to it. And I think that that's the case for any history of a people who were going through an ethnic cleansing until many decades later, when people are like, oh, actually, that is kind of what happened. Why do you think there is such resistance to that phrase today? I mean, obviously, we know that it serves like a colonial agenda to erase even the term or the concept or the story of it. But when the data is there, when the stories are documented, how do you even approach having that conversation to make sure that that history is preserved as well? Because so much of this struggle is preserving the history, preserving the culture, preserving the heritage.
You know, I don't understand why it would be controversial unless you're hell-bent on refusing reality and living in an alternate reality which you've created. And a lot of the times when you're Palestinian and you're simply speaking about your experience, like, hi, this happened to me.
Yep.
You are gaslit and you are told that either it didn't happen to you, you don't exist, you weren't expelled, but also we're going to do another Nakba. I mean, this is what the settlers were chanting at their rallies over the summer, right? And it shouldn't be controversial at all. I mean, what's the definition of ethnic cleansing? It's the systematic forced removal of an ethnic, racial, or religious group from a specific area with the intent of making the region ethnically homogenous. And that's exactly what's happening in Palestine. In 1948, there was a place called Palestine, and the majority of the people who lived there were Palestinian, mostly Muslims and Christians, and Palestinian Jews were a minority as well. And since 1948, the only thing that has happened is those Palestinians have been expelled and continue to be expelled, their houses demolished, their land stolen, their olive trees uprooted. This is all documented by Palestinian, Israeli, and international scholars and organizations. It's just a fact. It's just a reality. The Palestinians that are now languishing in refugee camps are also proof of this reality. They all came from somewhere and then they were expelled mm-hmm. from that place. And people have replaced them. And those people are foreign settlers and they come from all over the world and they're all Jewish. And the fundamental demographic makeup of Palestine has changed. In 1948, the Zionists expelled 80% of the Palestinian population within the matter of like a year. 80%, right? That's that number that you often hear quoted. It's like 700,000 to some accounts go up to 1 million, but that many or so Palestinians who were expelled from their homes. And 78% of the land of Palestine was taken without compensation in order to create the state of Israel, a state for Jewish people coming from all over the world to settle. I mean, it's absolutely insane if you try to characterize this in any way other than ethnic cleansing. There has been a removal of an indigenous population who have been made refugees, who are living outside of the land, and their replacement has taken place by foreign settlers. That is just a fact. I mean, Israel itself defines itself as a Jewish state. That is how it defines itself on the books. It's not like some sort of lofty conclusion for me to say that Israel is intending to make the land of Palestine completely homogenous and tries to maintain this Jewish majority. They talk about it all the time. They talk about the demographic threat, which is basically, oh, the Palestinians that we weren't able to ethnically cleanse, the ones that are still on the land, they're going to pose a demographic threat to us, because eventually they may outnumber us. The ethnic cleansing project, in other words, may not actually be successful because they continue to reproduce, their reproduction rates are, you know, exceed ours, and they have these debates all the time in public. We should listen to them when they talk. This is not something that is a secret or is shameful even in discussions in public in Israel. So I don't think that the term should be controversial at all. And I think this goes back to bad reporting, right? Reporting that doesn't express the reality on the ground. And that unfortunately confuses people, and it's intended to confuse mm-hmm. people. It's intended to make things sound, less black and white that they are, more in line with the whole, well, both sides have good points. No, both sides right. don't have good points. One side is being oppressed by an oppressor. It's accepted by the majority of the world, yet the people in power have certain interests that they are trying to protect and maintain, and they place those interests in advance of human rights and justice and equality. And that's a problem. But I mean, I was looking even just the other day at a New York Times headline that basically announced that Israel would be building more settlements in the occupied West Bank. And the conclusion that the article gave was that this would make it more difficult to create a Palestinian state. In other words, this would make it more difficult to achieve a two-state solution. And I'm sitting here looking at this headline, like, what reality do these people live in? Everybody in the world that is serious and speaking about this issue, from human rights organizations like Beit Salem, Human Rights Watch, Palestinian scholars, scholars in the U.S., scholars abroad, Israeli scholars that are looking at this issue, are all saying the same thing. And that is that there is one state, it's an apartheid state, it grants certain rights to a privileged portion of the population due to their background, i.e. they are Jewish, so they have rights. And that's exactly how Israel defines itself. It's not me analyzing it. And another group which has no rights or little rights or different rights, depending on where exactly they live on that land, right? So Palestinians in Jerusalem have rights that Palestinians in the West Bank don't have, and Palestinians in the West Bank have rights that Palestinians in Gaza don't have. And it's all a mishmash, but the general point is that if you're a Jewish Israeli, you have rights, and if you're a Palestinian, you don't have as many rights as your Jewish counterparts. And that is something
that we have
a word for.
Jewish Palestinians?
That's something we have a word for. It's called apartheid. Jewish Palestinians, they do still exist. They've always been a minority. But what we see, what has happened since the arrival of Zionism and the establishment of Israel, is that the Jewish people that lived in the land of Palestine, that I ethnically identified as Palestinian, for many of them, they got swept up into the settler colony, right? So we had on our podcast, for example, an activist, a Jewish Israeli activist who considers herself a Palestinian Jew, by the name of Hadar Cohen. She spends a lot of time in Jerusalem, but also in the United States. And her family has been in Palestine for over 10 generations. That means that her family has been in Palestine longer than the state of Israel, longer than Zionism. And her ancestors lived and existed in a time when they saw themselves as Palestinian as their Muslim and Christian counterparts, right? And so Hadar identifies as a Palestinian Jew. She carries a Jewish-Israeli passport today, but her politics are very different from the foreign settlers that are coming from Eastern Europe or the United States to settle in the land of Palestine that are not native to Palestine, right? They're coming from completely different places. They're not native to the land. Whereas in her family's case, they've been there for much longer than the settler colony has existed. They eat all the same foods that we eat. They have the same culture, right? But in the last couple of generations, and she talked about this on the show, it's been sort of muddled with the culture of Europe that, you know, comes in through the ethnic cleansing and the settler colonialism of Zionism, this heavy European influence as well that sort of dominates. It's very, very fascinating. And I encourage anyone who's listening, if they're interested in that, to go check out that episode with Hadar Cohen on the Palestine Pod.
Wow. So much to unpack, so much to delve into. I hear a lot of the tool of story being used as something that is leading the conversation. And I appreciated you mentioning that New York Times headline, because one of the things I think that's really important to talk about is the lack of evolution in media analysis when it comes to Palestine and how the typical stories have been approached and how much or how little those stories have evolved in the last few decades. As a storyteller yourself and a lawyer and an activist, what has been your reflective points on the evolution of media when it comes to telling this story?
I think there's a lot of laziness. I think there's a lot of resistance to opening your eyes and speaking about the facts on the ground the way that they are. If you're a journalist and you're writing about this issue and you conclude that the building of settlements in unoccupied Palestinian land in 2021 will make it harder for there to be a two-state solution, or will make it, you know, less viable for a Palestinian state to be created, then you are engaging in intellectual dishonesty, because we have a state, Israel, whose leader today, Naftali Bennett, has said there will never be a Palestinian state. It's not, the issue is not whether these settlements are going to make it more difficult to create a Palestinian state. The reality is that Israel has never been interested in Palestinians being sovereign on their own land, ever. And their leader today admits it, whereas previous leaders may have admitted it. They may have said, yeah, perhaps in the future, but, you know, not on these terms, whatever. Today, their leader is saying there will never be a Palestinian state. Report on that, because that's the issue, right? That's something that you need to grapple with. If you're reporting on, for example, the building of new settlements, talk about their illegality. Talk about what it means for the Palestinian land that was taken in order for those settlements to be built. Talk about who is going to live in those settlements. Where are they coming from? Talk about the families who have their, you know, olive groves and farms on that land that was stolen by Israel, and they were not compensated for it, and they were made refugees, like their Palestinian brothers and sisters who were made refugees every single decade going back to the Nakba and even before, when Israel stole Palestinian land. Talk about the fact that this is not an isolated incident. And I think this is super essential. This is part of a consistent, continuous campaign to slowly eat away at the land of Palestine. Just look at the maps over the years. Palestinians have been pushed into these tiny little enclaves where they exist either surrounded by wall or checkpoints or outposts or settlements or roads that they can't access because Israel has established Jewish-only roads and Palestinian roads in the occupied West Bank, which is Palestinian land. Talk about that. Talk about the fact that, of course, there's going to be no Palestinian state when Palestinians live in these isolated little islands that are worse than Bantustans, in the words of Nkosi Mandela, who we also had as a guest on our podcast. That's the reality on the ground. That's what it actually looks like, feels like, is like to be Palestinian if you live on the ground, much less if you're in Gaza, which is simply a prison. Nothing goes in, nothing goes out without Israeli approval, and that's been the case for the last 15-some years now. So why are we still talking about two states? I mean, it's completely disingenuous.
Is it a distraction?
To try to report on this issue. It's a total distraction to talk about this issue and then to say that, oh, the only, you know, real talking point or discussion here is, you know, about the two-state solution. Forget about that. Talk about the reality that the people are living in. And also talk about the conclusions today of human rights organizations and scholars working on this issue. Because they will tell you very clearly, there's one state, it's an apartheid state. You have rights if you're Jewish, you don't have rights if you're Palestinian. Period.
Mm. So the conversations, and if we were to lead with stories and conversations to deliver impact, they would be ones that are talking about, like, at the very minimum, everyone, like, Palestinians are fighting for their basic human rights and equality. And that is the conversation that everyone is fighting to have. But we're making it like this bigger, obscure idea that everybody knows isn't a possible solution anytime soon. And so when we focus up here, we're taking away from actually delivering impact in the way that we represent the story.
Human rights, equality, and the right to stay on their land.
And the
because
right to
that's
stay on
what
the
they've
land.
Been deprived of for more than seven decades now. We've been progressively kicked out of our land. And that's why Sheikh Jarrah, the fact that people are paying attention to it, great. I'm so happy that people are paying attention to an isolated instance of ethnic cleansing happening in Palestine. But guess what? Every Palestinian city and village was a Sheikh Jarrah. There are hundreds more examples where that came from. All you have to do is ask a Palestinian the age of my grandmother or grandfather why they don't live in Palestine. You know, they're Palestinian. Mm. Why aren't they there? What happened to them? You'll hear stories that will confirm that this process has been ongoing. And we are fighting for the ability to remain on our land, to live in dignity, to have rights, to be able to travel freely, to be able to move on our land, to be able to build institutions, to be able to live as human beings, humanized with dignity. Essential, basic human rights. But sometimes when the conversation focuses on, like you said, these sort of obscure, abstract, oh, is it going to be one state? Is it going to be two states? Is it going to be 10 states? How many times have I heard a Palestinian say to me, I don't care how many states there are, if there's 100 states or if there's zero states. We want to be on our land. We want to have our rights. And we don't want our land stolen. Like, it's that's what this is about. Stop complicating it. It's not complicated.
Hi there. If you find our work beneficial and you want to support how we build our company at your service, you can subscribe to my Patreon at patreon.com/nor. It's usually personal writings, and as I build a community on there, hopefully more. Your support is how we build. I also curate a weekly newsletter of all the things I'm benefiting from and enjoying that week. Anything from what I'm reading, watching, listening, buying, and more. Like most things, I keep it personal. You can subscribe to it at nortagori.com/newsletter. Now back to the story. It's funny to hear you say it's not complicated.
It's not.
And breaking it down so simply, because the amount of times I've heard it's just too complicated. It's just too complex.
Of course.
Nobody really understands it. And everything kind of like sometimes, obviously, I'm not the most well-versed person on the planet on this issue, and I'm learning about it still consistently. And yet, like, when people say that with such confidence of like, it's just too complicated to talk about, I'm like, what part of this complexity is the thing that you're hanging on to? Because there are just like, it's a very much like A plus B equals C situation. But again, like, the stories around it have played this really big part. I think that there's also Israel, of course, self-identifies as a Jewish state. And if I'm not mistaken, like, it's the only country in the world that identifies as like one faith specific state where, like, if you are of this faith, you can become a citizen. Correct?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any other scenario like that. It's
and it also has people around the world. So there are Jewish people both in Israel, in the United States, and around the world who, like, contest this idea because they understand what the Palestinian struggle is, and they are also confused or angry or have the same concerns. And this is where things get, I think, tricky in the conversations that I've heard is people will resort to anti-Semitism when talking about this, when really the this conversation dances around anti-Semitism or is anti-Semitic, but there's a big difference when talking about the state, like a political state versus a group of people who practice a faith or have like this heritage. And I mean, even your co-host on the Palestine Pod is Jewish, and there are so many Jewish voices who have been also on the forefront of this conversation. So when you're having conversations with other Jewish activists or Jewish people who, the way that I think about it is like when you're having a tense holiday dinner, like when we were having like the Trump conversations in different households and there was that tension around it. I assume that that same thing happens to so many Jewish people when they're at home and they're having these conversations. What is the dynamic that you, from your peers and colleagues and the people that you've worked with, what is the most common dynamic or struggle internally that people are having within their own families and workplaces? And what can help clarify that?
So I think what you have sort of identified here is the attempt to conflate Judaism, a religion, with Zionism, a political ideology.
Yes.
You don't have to be Jewish to be a Zionist. It's a political ideology. It's a belief that Jewish people from all over the world should go settle in the land of Palestine. And in fact, many Zionists are Christian Zionists, and they don't do so out of the goodwill of their heart because they love Jewish people so much that they want them to all have a place to live together. They do so out of deep-rooted anti-Semitism because they believe that this will usher in the second coming of Christ and essentially the rapture. So what we need to do is understand that there's a distinction between Judaism, a beautiful religion that has existed for thousands of years, with whom we share prophets as Muslims, and with beautiful teachings, and Zionism, which is a political ideology, and that was invented over 100 years ago in Europe.
With what intent?
To settle the land of Palestine, simply. To settle the land of Palestine, that's what they decided on. But initially it was just settle somewhere, right? So I often speak about how the early Zionists who were in Europe and were looking for sort of a solution to ill treatment of Jewish people in Europe, but also were starting to be inspired by these waves of nationalism that were taking place in Europe at the time, and they decided on this agenda for the creation of a Jewish state, and they eventually got external supporters in the form of the British Empire to prop up, this project. But before they even considered Palestine, they considered other places like Angola, like Azerbaijan, like other countries to settle and have their Jewish state in. But they eventually settled on Palestine because of its religious significance and the ability then to use that as a sort of tool when trying to recruit settlers for the new colony. So they were going to be able to market that to more religious Jews and say, hey, let's go back to that land because, thousands and thousands of years ago, there were Jews there at some point. And so let's us European Jews go there and claim that land as ours. And so going back to this whole thing of people telling you it's so confusing, you need a PhD to understand.
Yes.
It's not confusing, because those people, oftentimes what they try to do is they will try to tell you really long stories about the connection that Jewish people have to this land and how it's so ancient and so old. All of that is fine and well. If you want to move to Palestine and live in Palestine, no problem. But that doesn't give you a license to ethnically cleanse the indigenous population. Right? So what are we talking about here? Palestinians never would have had a problem welcoming anybody who wanted to live in Palestine to live in Palestine. In fact, that's exactly what they did for thousands of years. Palestine was this melting pot of and this sort of crossroad of civilizations. I mean, being literally in the center of the world with Africa and Europe and Asia, and plenty of people and different communities lived in Palestine and ruled in Palestine. I mean, I myself am a descendant of all of these great civilizations, from the Greeks to the Romans to the Byzantines to the Mamluks to the Ottomans. They were all in Palestine. That's what it means to be Palestinian. You're just on the land. And being on the land uninterrupted for a certain amount of time then gives you this indigeneity, because you know the land. You've worked the land. You've lived on the land. So you have this connection to the land that's physical. If you're a Jew in New York and you feel very deeply that you also have this connection to Palestine, okay, no problem. Come, move. Buy some land there. It doesn't matter, but you can't kick me out.
Right.
This is the disconnect, is that oftentimes these people are trying to confuse you.
That is the
you.
Quote unquote real estate dispute.
They are trying to confuse you. They are trying to tell you that whatever connection they have trumps your right as an indigenous person who has been on right. that land for generations and generations, who can trace their family history thousands of years on that land. But that you should be okay with being made a stateless refugee because their right allegedly trumps your right to remain, or their connection is stronger than your connection. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense. I can't go to you today, Noor, and say my connection to your apartment is stronger than your connection to your own apartment, so I'm just going to take it. It doesn't make sense. And we would never accept the logic of this fact pattern in any other scenario, but for some reason with Palestine, it's okay. And that's why I try to tell people.
Well, do you
people,
know
imagine,
what that for some reason is?
Yeah.
Do you know, like, what is that? What is that for some reason? Because sometimes when I think about it, I always wonder, is this because, like, is it always at this level of controversy when it comes to a colonizer settling on an indigenous land? Or is this because this is, like, our lifetime of seeing it, like, this clearly? Because we also, well, when it was in South Africa, was it a similar level of controversy when it came to the media representation, when it came to the taking over people's homes?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to remember that there was a time when settler colonialism and colonialism more broadly was an accepted means of governance and an accepted means of acquiring territory and an accepted means of expanding your empire. We used to live in a global system that was rooted in and thrived off of these really unjust modes of, you know, sharing and exerting power. Mm-hmm. That was the status quo at some point. But we now live in a world where that's no longer accepted. Israel is the last settler colony in existence. And it was
Israel
unjust
Israel is the
back
last
then.
Settler colony in existence?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Because after South Africa, there's only Israel. And I mean, we talk about this. We talk about this a lot on our podcast, where we talk about how Zionists actually learned from South African apartheid and the connections between South African apartheid and Israeli apartheid. It's obviously not exactly the same, but there's a lot of things that you can see. There's a lot of areas where you can see how Israel was inspired by apartheid in South Africa, we also, for example, had a scholar, Dr. Steve Salaita, come on our show, where he's a scholar of Native American studies. And he writes a lot about how Israel was and the early Zionists were inspired by settlers in the U.S. And they were specifically even called themselves settlers, you know, in their early writings. They referred to themselves as colonizing the land of Palestine. This wasn't controversial. They knew what they were doing because it was just accepted parlance at the time to speak about yourself as a colonizer. The colonialism was good, that colonizing will be good for the land of Palestine, right? And so if you look back at the writings of the early Zionists, they're very outspoken about this, that they're colonizing, that they're settling, that they are creating colonies. But today, Zionists and their supporters will tell you, no, that's not what they're doing. They're doing something totally different. It's just because they have a connection to the land. Okay. Well, look back at your own figures. Look back at your own leaders of this political ideology that you espouse and see very clearly what their plan was all along.
Hi, I hope you're enjoying the storytelling session. I just wanted to share something with you. If you're looking for a good deed opportunity these days, my family has been working to alleviate local homelessness for over 10 years. We have a foundation called I See You, and we make care packages for people experiencing homelessness. We make family food bags with food staples and give out grocery gift cards to families in need and more. Everything is done by donation, and 100% of the money goes towards community members in need. If you'd like to donate, you can through Venmo at ISY Foundation or PayPal to contact@isyfoundation.org. If you or someone you know is in need in the DC, Maryland, and Virginia area and could use our help, please DM on Instagram ISY Foundation or shoot us an email. Now back to our story. Another really big tool that is different this time around than it, like in South Africa or before, is the use of the internet and social media. And even when, and this is something I learned from you, but even when you go to visit, if you were going to go visit Palestine, you are expected to show your social media pages. Like people, you are going to be searched on the internet. What is the purpose of this control, and how has censorship of what's going on in Palestine played a role in how the rest of the world, and specifically America, since we provide so much money and resources to Israel, how does that add to the narrative?
To answer the first part of your question, relating to, you know, what is the purpose of this? Why does Israel ask Palestinians in exile who are going back to visit Palestine, or people more generally, to show their social media pages? Mm-hmm. And, you know, really invasive questions about their politics, about their positions. And the answer is because they're trying to intimidate and to threaten us. They don't want us to be political. They don't want us to be vocal about what has happened to us. They don't want us to be activists by any means.
But if you do post certain things on social media, does that impact your chance of being able to get into the country?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, definitely. And that's why, you know, a lot of people may... You know, it's a risk that you take once you become involved with this work from the outside. And, you know, Palestinians have, you know, we're creative people. We've come up with ways to try to minimize the impact of, you know, of this type of treatment. But the fact is that they do this to silence, to intimidate, to threaten, to make sure that three generations later, Palestinians are not still trying to go back to Palestine, because that would mean that their settler colonial project has failed, that they have failed to disconnect us from the land, and that we still pose a threat to them in the sense of, well, what if they try to come back? What if they try to come back and live here, right? And
well,
so
and it doesn't even have to just be you visiting. I mean, you are very vocal about censorship that you experience on Instagram.
Yeah, definitely. So the other part of that is the censorship that we face as a result of engaging with social media and being on social media platforms. And, you know, there's a lot that can be said about this topic. And, you know, I've covered it really extensively on our podcast, but also like on my own Instagram page. But the one thing I want to highlight is that when everybody was paying attention to what was happening in Palestine in May, it was a critical moment for us as Palestinians to be able to tell the world our story, because there was a light that was shining and a space that was allocated for this topic. And there was an audience that basically woke up and said, hey, wait a minute, what's going on in Palestine? I want to know what's going on. And a lot of those people were in the U.S. And that's an essential place to change minds about the struggle for Palestinian rights. Because if you were an American, your government is contributing financially, diplomatically, and more to apartheid. It is contributing by giving $3.8 billion and sometimes more to Israel every year. It is contributing by shielding Israel from any criticism for its violations of human rights on the world stage. It is contributing by being, you know, the number one cheerleader of Israel, and supporter and backer
in both political parties
of Israel, in both political parties. Absolutely. You know, there was a lot of attention on Palestine when Trump was in office, because people were seeing the brutality of U.S. policy towards Palestinian rights. But for many Palestinians, we would argue that nothing actually really changed, in the sense that U.S. policy was always supportive of Israeli crimes, but it just used different language previously in previous administrations to sort of cover up the reality of its politics towards Palestine. And what Trump really did was just, you know, lift the cover off of what previous administrations were doing, which was trying to maintain like a sort of semblance of being like this fair arbiter between the two parties, but realistically providing full, you know, unconditional support to Israel to pursue the policies that it pursues. Whereas what Trump really did was just say what he was doing, and he just put it all out there. But he didn't really fundamentally change the course of U.S. policy towards Palestine. He really just continued what the U.S. had been doing all along. But in terms of the question of censorship from social media companies, so this is something, as I mentioned, that I've spoken about quite a lot. And if you want to go into, you know, why this is happening, there's a lot that has been published that's available in you know, media about connections between the major social media companies, Facebook, for example, and the Israeli government. These are the types of things that have been reported on by Politico, The Intercept. Facebook, for example, has hired to be on its oversight board a former Israeli government official. And so that person is responsible for filtering through a lot of the content that is, or at least setting the policies for and participating in the discussions on what gets filtered on social media. And I mean, these are things that your listeners can easily look up. But what I want to focus on is the extent to which Palestinian voices were censored in May, during a critical time of uprising, when the world's attention was turned to Palestine, and when we had the opportunity to change minds in the U.S., which is an essential jurisdiction, a place where we need to change minds in order to eventually impact policy on the ground. And, you know, just from my own personal experience, I had posts that were deleted for being quote unquote hate speech that had nothing to do with hate speech. Rather, I was actually showing hate speech that was being directed at us as an attempt to raise awareness about that hate speech. But I was, in doing so, blocked by Instagram for my post constituting itself hate speech. So this goes back to the question of conflating Zionism and Judaism. And so what Zionists have done is they have pushed for definitions of anti-Semitism that include speaking out against Zionism. In other words, if you are critical of this political ideology that promotes the settlement of Jews from all over the world in Palestine at the expense of the native population, then you can be branded as an anti-Semite, i.e. a person who hates Jewish people for being Jewish or belonging to the Jewish religion. Right. And they've been actually very successful at promoting this new definition of anti-Semitism. They got Trump to actually adopt it. It's known as the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism. It's something that as Palestinians we are dealing with, because what it does is it makes it much more difficult for us to speak about the injustices that we are experiencing. Because the reality is, the injustices that we are experiencing are the result of Zionism, are the result of the implementation of the Zionist project in Palestine. And you can't deny this. It's Zionism which says that Jews must settle in the land of Palestine. And it's Zionist leaders which said that they must expel the native inhabitants. These are their words, not mine. And they are, to a T, carrying out their project. And so, going back to social media, well, unfortunately, social media right now doesn't really know how to deal with this. Should we be allowed to speak about Zionism? Should we be allowed to criticize Zionism? Or in doing so, are we making anti-Semitic statements? Well, I don't know where the situation stands in terms of the actual policies of the social media companies as of today, but I can tell you that in May, when my posts were deleted, there were posts that were deleted where I wasn't even being critical of Zionism as an ideology. I had posts that were deleted where I was merely showing the world what was happening to my own family in real time. One of the posts that was deleted was a picture of my family's apartment building in Gaza moments before it was hit by an Israeli airstrike. And that post was deleted for being quote unquote hate speech. And I was so stunned by the amount of information and content that was being removed from my account. My account was threatened for deletion. I had to go through back channels to find people that knew people that knew people that worked at Instagram to get certain posts restored. Eventually, Instagram told me that all of that content was removed due to a quote unquote mistake, an error. They didn't exactly specify what the error was, but they told me that it was done, you know, without reason, and they eventually restored the content many weeks later in some cases. But what I want to highlight here and what I think is so important, and this is something that Human Rights Watch actually concluded in a very recent article that they published on this question of censorship of Palestinian activists, actually specifically citing to the instances of censorship that my own account faced. So they actually referenced those accounts.
Oh.
They said that these removals suggest that Instagram is restricting freedom of expression on matters of public interest. And this is a really critical point. They also go on to say, even when social media companies reinstate wrongly suppressed material, the error impedes the flow of information concerning human rights at critical moments. And that's exactly what they did.
Can you read that last part one more time for our listeners? That was really
great. Yeah. So the Human Rights Watch report investigating these incidents of censorship of Palestinian accounts and posts, including my own account, concluded that even when social media companies reinstate wrongly suppressed material, the error impedes the flow of information concerning human rights at critical moments.
So it's like when you are essentially a citizen journalist and you're breaking news and you're bringing new information, it's not just an error of a tech company. It is literally preventing journalism that is critical in shaping public opinion, which actually I would love to ask you about. One of the things that we're investigating in the series that I'm working on right now on media representation is around this triangulation between politics, public opinion, and pop culture. When you consider the Palestinian story, which one do you think triggers? I mean, all of them play roles, like politics, pop culture, and public opinion all impact each other. But is there one of these facets that you think has a bigger influence on the other, or helps like push the die or push the dominoes? Dominoes is what I was thinking.
Politics, pop culture, and what was the last one?
Public opinion.
Well, look, I mean, the public opinion is shifting in our favor. I mean, we especially in the United States, we often cover the recent polls in terms of, you know, for example, which percentage of American Jews think that Israel is an apartheid state. And that number is growing. Which number of American Jews identify as Zionists? That number is decreasing. How many Americans in general sympathize with the Palestinian cause? That number is also increasing. And so the poll is, you know, the polls are shifting in our favor. And politics is the one thing where I think, you know, it's always going to be the last thing to budge, right? Because in order for there to be a change on the political, landscape, we need to have reached a point where the public opinion has shifted so much
that there's that no choice.
The cost of supporting the apartheid state becomes greater than the benefits to the United States in terms of having a military stronghold in the Middle East, in terms of, you know, being able to dominate the region through Israel, you know, and so on and so forth. And so it's really just a question of what costs more. And right now, the U.S. gets away with supporting Israel because the cost of it supporting Israel and Israeli policy is not high enough for it to reconsider that balance. But, you know, there certainly has been changes and advances on this front. I mean, during this time, we had discussions in Congress for the first time in God knows how long about reconsidering military aid to Israel, right? Obviously, it didn't change anything, and eventually additional aid was given to Israel.
But you just explained why. Like that is such a clear understanding of, like, it just goes to show you how hard it is to change politics and to push policy forward, which can go into a completely other conversation. I mean, we see the fact that we're still talking about Roe versus Wade and that abortion rights are still up for debate is like, there, even when things change, there's still a way for them to resort back to the original, like our original stances, which are often rooted in some form of oppression.
Yeah, absolutely. Nothing is inevitable and nothing is guaranteed to remain a certain way just because, you know, the tide has shifted. I mean, this work is constant work. It's daily work. It's work that involves...
Why do you choose to do this work?
Yeah.
This work in the podcast space and the activism space and also the legal space. Like, is this also why you wanted to become a lawyer?
Yeah. I mean, it's a question that I don't always stop to think about, like, why am I doing all this, right? But I think it's because I have a lot of different things that do motivate me. And so there isn't just like one thing, right? Certainly one aspect of it is my belief in God and my belief in a just God, who doesn't love oppression. That motivates me. Knowing that that's certainly, you know, a huge aspect of it, knowing that I will be questioned for what I did with my time on this earth, with the resources that I was blessed with the skills that I was blessed with. That's something that motivates me. I mean, there definitely is a spiritual component to this.
Does that also contribute to a healing journey as well? When referring to, and I'm referring to the intergenerational trauma that we talked about earlier, I keep thinking about what you said about your grandparents, and then your grandparents had this, like, they were living their lives and then became refugees more than once, and then your parents held on to education. And I feel like our parents' generation, especially what, like, when moving out of the homeland, like, education was this thing that they could hold on to, and they were like, this is our key to everything. I mean, hey, I think I believe that has changed today, because now we know that education doesn't guarantee, you know, success, and success is up for debate anyway, but like, that was something that so many people held on to. And then like, your generation and the generations to come after that have had enough breathing room and space, at least there's still trauma, of course, but there's enough room between what happened to your grandparents and your great grandparents where you have the energy to be like, this unjust thing I feel like I have to do something about.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, even my own parents didn't want me to be an activist. They were like, no, you can't do that. You'll be targeted. And
it's survival.
You know, they would... Yeah, survival. They were afraid that I would be targeted, that I would suffer racism, that I would suffer.
They're not wrong. All sorts of.
Yeah, no, they're not. They're definitely not wrong. But like I said before, I mean, for me, it isn't so much a choice, but just sort of this realization that, okay, I have to speak about this. Like, it's beyond even it being a choice. You know, for a long time, I was involved in activist groups in college in the U.S. And community groups in Chicago, where I lived and grew up. And then when I moved to France, I sort of lost touch with my activist community, because now I'm living an expat life. And so I'm just kind of dropped into this new community, a different culture, different language. And so for a few years, my activism was on pause. And I used to just sit there and just say this to my husband for like hours at a time. I would just, you know, unload on him, you know, about just my thoughts about racism and colonialism and being a refugee and, you know, being Palestinian and all of this. And he would always say to me, we have to record this. Like, you can't just say this to me. Everyone needs to hear this. And that's eventually how I, you know, decided to start the podcast. But that's the thing. For me, it wasn't really an option. It was just this thing that I was doing anyway. I mean, I was doing it since I was 18. But even when I sort of left the environment that allowed that sort of activism to flourish, I just kept doing it. But I was just doing it at my loved ones, at the people who were closest to me. And I needed to recreate that outlet for myself. And of course, you know, living in the world that we live in, where technology is a tool to help you transcend those borders, you know, you can do things like create a podcast and have listeners from all over the world. And that's been a really, really powerful and rewarding experience. And I do think that it also contributes to shifting public opinion and changing the parameters of the debate. I get messages all the time from people who are like, I didn't know anything about Palestine, and then I listened to your podcast. I get messages from former Zionists who are like, I used to be a Zionist, but I listened to your podcast. I mean, doesn't happen every day, but it's happened at least a handful of times.
Wow.
And that is huge.
How does that make you feel?
That's huge. You know, I mean, it's definitely motivation to keep going, right? It's motivation to keep going. And it's motivation.
How do you receive those messages? Like, how do you engage with them?
I'm very thankful that people take the time to listen, you know, because there's a lot of content on the internet. The internet is, is certainly replete with content, whether free or paid, certainly tons of free content. And we make our podcast free and available to everyone. But the, you know, there's a lot of places where people can invest their time. So the fact that they've chosen to spend an hour with us, certainly every week, in some ways it feels like a huge ask. But when they do, I'm incredibly grateful that they give us that opportunity, that they let us into their homes, that they let us talk about our experiences. And then that it also causes in them some sort of a shift, you know, a shift in mindset, a shift in perception, how they see things about Palestine, how they respond to headlines that are just confusing and not really reporting on the real issues. It definitely gives me the motivation to keep going. You know this as well as I do, Noor. I mean, this work is very laborious. And, you know, in my case, it's not my day job. So it's a lot of
free
work.
Yeah, but your day job does play in this space. You're like,
yeah,
you,
yeah,
that's,
definitely.
Like, is this part of why you wanted to become a lawyer?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I wanted to do human rights work ever since I knew that it existed. And I wanted to, I really wanted to work with refugees. And now I'm very blessed to be able to say that a large part of my legal practice actually is devoted to accompanying refugees in asylum proceedings in France. And several of my clients have been Palestinian, especially Palestinians who are fleeing Syria, which, I mean, that in and of itself is a story of intergenerational trauma. I recently represented clients who were granted asylum in France that originally hailed from 48 territories in Palestine, were expelled during the Nakba of 1948, made refugees to Syria, where they lived for many decades in the Yarmouk refugee camp, which is one of the largest Palestinian refugee camps in the Middle East. And then in 2011, when the Syrian revolution started, which eventually evolved into the civil war, their refugee camp was totally destroyed and they became refugees yet again, but this time from Syria. And so then they went to Lebanon, experienced really difficult circumstances, lots of racism and an inability to get paperwork that would actually allow them to, you know, remain in the country and, you know, pursue a life there. And so we were able to represent them and bring them over to France and eventually got them refugee status so that now they can rebuild their life. But like, you know, just looking at that story, it's just injustice after injustice after injustice that just continues to follow them wherever they go. And at the root of it is the fact that they can't go back to Palestine because Israel won't let them. That's the you know, the core central issue. And Israel won't let them because of Zionism, because of this political ideology, which says that it is more important for Jewish people to settle the land of Palestine than it is for the people who are from Palestine, who live in Palestine for many generations, going back thousands of years, to remain in Palestine. And so that is why, you know, anybody that I work with on this issue, you brought up the question of Jewish allies. I have plenty of Jewish allies. They're all anti-Zionists. That's something that we don't compromise on. We don't compromise on having different viewpoints on Zionism. Zionism is racism. Zionism is the political ideology that fuels settler colonialism and apartheid in Palestine. So you can't try to be an ally of any kind if you are an apologetic for Zionism. And a lot of people try to maintain the semblance of, yeah, I care about human rights, but I'm also a Zionist because Zionism is really, you know, special and this is what Zionism means to me. You can't say that about a racist ideology. It doesn't matter what it means to you. What matters is what has it concretely produced in terms of results. And we know what the results are of the implementation of the Zionist project in Palestine. Just look back at what's happened since 1948 and earlier. The creation of one of the world's largest refugee problems. Palestinians have been expelled from their land, and we are all over the world and prevented from returning to our land, and our land continues to be stolen. Like, this is the very real black and white factual consequence of implementing a Zionist project in Palestine. So it doesn't really matter what it means to you. What matters is what it has done. And the Jewish activists that I work with, that I have so much love and compassion for, and this is a thing that Zionists don't want the world to understand, is that the love and compassion between a Palestinian and an anti-Zionist Jew is extremely deep. I get messages all the time from Arab Jews from all over the Middle East that are anti-Zionists, that are telling me, you know, I'm with you, I support you. And I, and for me, I'm like, I'm with you and I support you, because I know that that can be difficult to stand up against Zionists in their own communities.
Right.
Because they may not come from fully anti-Zionist communities, right? I had a friend recently convert to Judaism, and she was telling me how difficult it was for her to find an anti-Zionist congregation. And eventually she found one. But like, for her, that was the essential thing that she needed to find. So there is this unfortunate mixing of this political ideology with the religion, even though the religion in and of itself says nothing about Zionism. I mean, Zionism was invented just over 100 years ago. The prophets of Judaism go back way farther than anything that Theodor Herzl said, right? You know, at the in the late 1800s, who was the founder of modern political Zionism. So yeah, we have to know what our principles are. We have to be uncompromising on our principles. And our principles are human rights, dignity, equality, not using brute force and violence, and, one of the world's most powerful militaries against a civilian population. I mean, these are things that reasonable people can agree on.
Laura, you have given us more than just a history lesson and a media analysis lesson and some French bulldog loving. For those of you who are listening, we've had a bulldog guest on here as well.
For those who are watching, they've seen him slowly creep up. He was on the floor. He was in the background. Now he's fully on the mic.
We love it. That's actually my next podcast guest. So thank you, Laura. I'll hit up his agent. I have some not so rapid fire questions, and I say that because, you know,
okay,
what a rapid fire. But all right, first question: What is a book that has changed the way that you think about something that you've read recently?
About Palestine or not about Palestine?
You can answer that. Whatever's on your heart.
Okay, about Palestine. I think one of the best intro books to this topic is Rashid Khalidi's 100-Year War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism from 1917 to 2017. That's an excellent book. Pick it up. You will not be disappointed. And it really helped me consolidate a lot of my ideas about our struggle and our story, and really just organize my thoughts so that, you know, when I speak, I am clearer to people and I make more sense to my audience, especially if they don't know, you know, anything about Palestine. So I really recommend that book. Not about Palestine, which is rare because I don't read much that's not about Palestine. But you know that book, Secrets of Divine Love?
Yeah.
I loved that book. I thought it was so lovely. It put me in such a good mood. Obviously, I haven't read it yet. Okay. It's going to make more sense for your Muslim listeners because it's sort of like the Eat, Pray, Love Islamic version. But it's super inspiring and it really put my heart at ease. And it was there's so many great one-liners that just leave you very tranquil and peaceful, and it was really a pleasure to read. So I would say that one.
Your favorite Palestinian dish?
Msakhan, 100%. Don't have to think about it.
My grandma makes amazing msakhan that she learned from her Palestinian friends, and she's taught it to us. I've literally made it in the house that I'm in right now, and I could live off of that. I literally could just. It's so good. Msachen, so for good. Those of you who don't know, involves bread, chicken, onions, and a whole lot of sumac.
Yeah, exactly. And the onions are caramelized for a very long time. Yes. And when we say onions, like, we're not talking about like one onion. We're not talking about like two onions. We're talking about multiple kilos of onions, like at least 25.
It's a commitment. It's a smell commitment.
It's a full day long process of just getting the onions caramelized and reduced and building that flavor. And it's a really amazing dish because it is a peasant dish. I mean, it grew out of the villages in Palestine. It's a villager's dish, you know, like a dish of like the Falahi community, right? But it has tremendous flavor from the sumac, from the caramelized onion. And the tabun bread has just the perfect texture. I'm really into bread. I make my own bread. And tabun bread it's similar to naan, similar-ish. It's chewy. It's pulley. It's got great texture.
I'm
it's
so just hungry.
Perfect. Yeah, it's just perfect. I could talk about msachen for a long time. In fact, even I will say one thing. Before the pandemic, I had this idea to start an msachen supper club in Paris. And I had like two events. And then the pandemic happened, so it got shut down.
Oh my gosh.
But I was like, I need to just make msachen for as many people as I can. And so, I'm
really, I also think that would be a great episode of the Palestine pod. I think it would be a great episode for the Palestine pod to do an episode on msachen where it's just like, you could even record yourself, just like the audio. It's ASMR of you making it, of you eating it.
Yes.
Of your dog chewing on it. Like, it would just, it would be so iconic.
This is
so
funny because this is not the first time that I have spoken to someone about doing like a Palestine themed ASMR sort of thing.
Well, that just came to my brain right now. And so
there's more than one person thinking about this. Maybe there's something here.
There has to be.
I'm supposed to help Michael make it on one of our Patreon episodes. So that is in the works.
Ooh, we got a Patreon over here. What is your favorite song to Debka to?
Oh my God, I literally don't know any of the song names. I literally don't know any of the
song names. That means you have to sing it. I don't actually know the names of any.
For me, like, of course I don't know their names. I literally only know Demi Falestini by Mohammed Assaf. Like, I also know that song. This is a thing. I don't have that level of cultural awareness. Like, I never grew up on the folkloric songs because simply like my parents didn't teach them to us. And I'm not even sure that they necessarily knew them. Like, these are things that I in adulthood have gone back and like tried to learn. So I'm like learning like children's folkloric songs from Palestine as like a 34-year-old woman.
That's awesome. That's like, I mean, you're doing it with an awareness that you may not have had when you were younger. Like, there's still.
Yeah.
And speaking of which, how do you approach reframing this whole, like, how do you reframe your life given all of like the story and the roller coaster that exists in your generation, your parents, your grandparents? Like, how do you frame that story now?
I feel like my purpose is very much to make sense of what happened in the last couple of generations and pave a way for the future generation. And every Palestinian living in this time period that is involved in the struggle is contributing to that in some way, becoming a part of that historical process. I don't want future generations to forget that they're Palestinian. I don't want them to forget their culture, their food, their identity, their language, their history. I don't want them to forget the injustice that that their families lived through. And it's, for me, it's about contributing to the public record in some way that's tangible. And I think that's really what I want to be able to leave on this earth, is just, hey, in 2021, there was people talking about this. There was Palestinians in exile talking about this. And if I can be a part of that part of the story, then I'll feel like I left something useful for the people who come after.
Wow, mashallah. And finally, Laura, what do you know? Oh my gosh, the snoring. I love it. We're keeping that. What do you know for sure?
What do I know for sure? I know that racism is bad for sure. yeah. And I mean, that's the thing is like you were asking me, well, how do you frame the issue of Palestine? We're in an anti-racist struggle. It's an anti-racist struggle that anybody who hates racism can sympathize with. Mm. And there's no way to try to spin it to make it look more, you know, positive or to put it, you know, to shine it in a sort of rosy light. Racism is bad. It's always bad. And there's very little things I know for sure, but I definitely know that.
I love it. Thank you so much. You've given us so much of your time. This may be my longest podcast episode.
Really?
Yeah.
Probably because I forced you to take so many breaks. I was like, I'm leaving.
Hold more on. So. They won't know that. More so, I just, like, I'm so grateful of how much we covered. And even then, there's, like, so much more that you can learn about. And for all of you who are listening, who have open ears, hearts, and minds, and want to learn more, you can, of course, do that and listened to the Palestine pod. We just found out they had you guys have a Patreon. What else can we do to support you and your work?
Yeah, I mean, give me a follow on Instagram for as long as Instagram lets me keep my account before they nuke it at Gazan Girl. I'm sometimes active on Twitter at the Gazan Girl. And if you like the Palestine pod, we keep it fully free and ad free. Mm-hmm. It's available wherever podcasts are streamed and on YouTube. And if you like it and you want to support us and you want access to additional content, feel free to find us on Patreon.
Laura E. Gazan Girl, thank you so much for your time, for your love, for your openness, for your stories. This was such a delight.
Thank you so, so, so much, Noor. Pleasure was mine.
I hope you enjoyed this storytelling session with Laura, aka Gazan Girl. You can follow her on Instagram at Gazan Girl, GAZANGIRL. And make sure you subscribe to the Palestine pod and leave a review. While you're at it, I would love if you could leave us a review for this podcast. And I will see you next week.